This is part B of the Doolanders interview with Rob Gell. This is the first time you're hearing this. Make sure you check out part A, then come back to this one. Otherwise, enjoy.
31 years in the business, you worked with some truly amazing people, I would imagine, and some absolute household names in people like Brian Naylor and David Johnson, Jan Event, Jennifer Kite. What are the things that, like, that's a big span of time, but when you think back on that period of time in your life and those people's influence on you, what comes to mind?
It's a good question, and David Johnson's a great mate. We see each other infrequently, but we run to each other occasionally, and David's a really well-adjusted, down-to-earth, nice guy. He worked in television, then he went out of television, ran news agencies, and then came back to Channel O and was very successful and then retired. Not everybody's a David Johnson in the television industry. Some of them are terrific. Yana, I haven't seen Yana for many years, but we worked together in the early days of Channel 10. Very lovely, very clever woman, and really took the Nine Network in particular to task on some of the things that they said they weren't going to do but then expected her to do, and she reminded them that she'd agreed, that they'd agreed that she wouldn't be doing that stuff, if I make do it politely. But she's happily living in Sydney. Who else? Some eccentric people too. I remember going to a football final with Graham Kennedy in the Channel 9 box at the MCG. I mean, Kennedy's a nutty St Kilda supporter. And you just... quite unusual people. Mm. And there's a whole lot of others who are not very nice people. Mm. They live in a false world of whatever, which I don't understand. I was very lucky. In my first year of doing the wet on the telly, I remember going down to Lawn for Easter to catch up with mates and do whatever. And I walked into the Lawn Hotel and I saw Scott Nicholson, who was house captain and I was vice captain in our final year of school. And he'd gone to the bar, and so I just walked up to the bar and said, "G'day, Scotty, how are you?" And he said, "Oh, g'day, Rob." He said, "I saw you come in, but I didn't know whether you'd want to talk to me now that you're working in television."
Right.
And it was a really important lesson, because I was like 3 months into the job. I said, "My God, if that's what people think might happen to me, I have to be really careful that however long I spend working in this business, I must always be able to talk to my schoolmates the same way I did at school." And that was a really salient lesson. And then I was lucky also that, well, I started working in radio, so that meant I wasn't beholden just to the television station, and they knew that was important. But then I sort of, by the early 90s, a few other things, but I got into working with non-profit organisations, but more particularly we started an environmental consultancy. So that took me into the real world, and away from the unreal world of television, because I think you used the word magnifying glass or the lens of a thing. It's a microcosm. I mean, it frightens me, and I consume a fair bit of media, particularly a lot of radio, I guess, and it frightens me the lack of understanding in Australia about the big global issues. I mean, I used the words a couple of days ago, that we are not only geographically isolated, we're intellectually isolated in this country from what's going on in the rest of the world, from the EU in particular. I mean, the EU is now forging ahead on the things that need to be done. Biden's now doing the same things in the States, and believe it or not, the Chinese are as well. Mm. They're out there doing hard tech and smart stuff in what will become the new world economy. A mate of mine, a guy called... Well, he's not a mate of mine, but I haven't seen him for a decade. A guy called John Elkington, who wrote interesting books like Cannibals with Forks and the Chrysalis Economy, but he's the father of people might understand if I say he's the father of what we call the triple bottom line, where we had to start measuring social impact and environmental impact along with economic impact. Now, John's just, after 25 years, John's done a product recall on the triple bottom line. But he's now talking about this being the regenerative decade. He says we're going to see things change faster in this decade in everything than we've ever seen before.
Right.
So in energy and recycling and economics and stuff like that, and there's a maelstrom of stuff out there, but we don't see it in our media in Australia. Mm. We're just not getting exposed to any of it, and our politicians, black, brindle, white, whatever, have no idea. They're just not bringing the stuff. Not even the Greens, frankly, which is a bit, you know, which you'd expect it might generate from. But you can find it online. So the Australia Institute and some of the good institutes are bringing the smart stuff. So a woman, for everyone listening, go and find out what donut economics is all about. Donut economics by Kate Raworth.
Yep.
Kate Raworth teaches at both Oxford and Cambridge.
Yep.
And she's got, and Mariana Mazzucato, it's interesting, they're all women, Stephanie Kelson from American Woman. These women are, and some Steve Keen and some other great men around the world, are reimagining our economic system because the current one doesn't work.
Yeah, it doesn't. The
current system does not deliver. Here we are, a wealthy country like Australia with iron ore, $200 a ton, and we still haven't got a fully functioning health or education system. Give me a break.
Yeah. Doesn't make sense.
Does not make sense.
Yeah.
Why? Yeah. What about our transport system? I mean, the roads are worse now than they were, whatever. We haven't built a new railway line in Melbourne since 1956 or something like that, the railway line to Waverley, which is around the time of the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
I mean, we've built the two new stations up towards Epping or somewhere, and the regional rail network, but that's only to unclog a clogged up system. I mean, we seriously, why don't we, you guys been to China recently?
No.
I was in China, in Beijing in 17, I think. And I went from Beijing to Nanjing to give a lecture, travelling at 310 kilometres an hour with Wi-Fi. And I got off the train in Nanjing and I was picked up by some young women from the university and 45 people at 5 o'clock at night listened to me for an hour and a half or more. Could have taken more questions from people from all over the world, just thirsty for knowledge about whatever the hell I was talking about. Stayed for a couple of nights and looked around some, and then went back and actually understood the railway station that I'd arrived in at Nanjing. It's about the size of the MCG. Wow. It's polished marble and granite. It's got 22 gates for fast trains that do 310 kilometres an hour. You can buy a Louis Vuitton handbag. You can probably buy a Maserati or something like that if you want to as well. But it's quiet. People are peaceful. You go and get on the train and it whisks you off in 3 hours' time and you're in Beijing. Mm. It is the most – and it's got starlight on the inside of the – it's the most extraordinary thing. And this is – so I said – I remember when I got – as soon as I could get back on the social media, could we please have one fast train
just
in Australia?
One.
Just one?
Yeah.
Because it is such a better way to travel – if you've got to travel the distance between Melbourne and Sydney, you know, Huawei wanted to build it for us, but we didn't want to work with Huawei. You know, Huawei, China wants to build a fast train to London, and they want to build another one to New York City.
Wow.
Because we can.
Yeah.
Is our problem density between Melbourne and Sydney versus the same distance in China where you'd have...
Well,
300 million people.
You know, I just hate catching airplanes anymore. I mean, I did a lot of it, public speaking, after I finished working in television, but it's the most clunky thing to do. It's ridiculous. So why can't we go and get on a... I mean, I'd rather drive to Sydney than catch a plane, frankly.
Yeah.
It takes about, you know, all in all, 10 hours.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stop, have a couple, you know, and no security and all that sort of stuff.
So when you think about all of that, how does... our relationship with change need to change in Australia?
Well, one of my – Jeff Weir, who runs the Dolphin Research Institute down at Hastings, is a good mate of mine. I haven't seen him for a bit. But he once hit me with a phrase, and I've pinched it from him. Respect, Jeff. In Australia, we need to develop a lust for change. Mm. We need to look to change just about everything. So, I mean, I listened to the Federal Treasurer Friday a week ago on a budget breakfast with a group of people, and there's no change here. There's nothing here. This is what you know. One of the other people on the panel was Peter Costello, and said, "This is a, you know, this is a Peter Costello budget. We do you not understand that the world's rapidly changing? I mean, there's nothing about electric vehicles, there's nothing about our emissions, there's nothing about transformation of our energy system, there's nothing about decarbonisation of the energy networks, there's nothing about, you know, there's nothing about protection of threatened species, there's nothing about biodiversity, there's nothing that's challenging the great problems that the planet's facing, and Australia's a laggard in most of the important ones. There's nothing here that's anything other than trying to get to back to business as usual in a pre-COVID world, which is not going to be good enough.
Yeah. We don't often get political on this podcast. It's generally, you know, more light than shade. But, like, I look into the leaders of this country and just my personal opinion, they lack authenticity, diversity, empathy and really – really the ability to deliver that step change that you're talking about. And there's this right now, there's this real need for evidence-based decision making. How do we make that step change from your opinion?
Well, we're playing with media. I'm going to talk about media now. These questions, it's not about what to believe, it's from whom do you believe things.
Yeah,
we have a massive problem in this country with the management of our media, and there's a monopoly organisation, and the information that you're reading in the Herald Sun or the Australian in particular is in the areas that we need to change is incorrect.
Right.
So you need to broaden your go and buy another
scope.
Paper.
Yep.
You know.
Do they believe it to be incorrect? Or do they know?
They know it's incorrect. They know it's incorrect. Oh, we've got minute. We've had we have parliamentarians who have had ministerial roles who know that what they're saying is incorrect.
What's an example of that?
I believe that Matthew Canavan, as the former Minister of Energy, knows that what he's saying about coal and the need for coal mines is completely and utterly incorrect.
Mm. Yeah.
So what's playing out in the background there?
Oh, it's the coal industry.
But what encourages
vested interest?
Yeah,
for them personally, because a lot of people who
Matthew Canavan's brother has got a share in a coal mine.
There you go. Mm.
So you need to understand where the messaging is coming from, and distill it for yourself. You know, go and understand. Find people without vested interests.
Yeah.
To understand, to at least understand what their view is, rather than accepting, a prescribed view. Which is going to leave my granddaughter living in a world where she won't be thanking me.
Yeah. So if you think about our gazes right now, from what we see and read, appear really low, and we're focused on the here and now, horizon one. What do we need to do for the global village and for the betterment and for your granddaughter and our kids? What do we need to do?
Oh, I'm becoming a little more hopeful that the rest of the world's just going to drag Australia along, kicking and scraping to a place that we're not comfortable being. And you can entertain the view that our government's quite happy with that, where they won't be blamed for going somewhere where they ostensibly don't want to go, but the rest of the world told us. Mm. So, for example, the EU has now got close to, I think it's €1 trillion for their Green Deal, transforming their economy.
Mm.
And they're having conversations, and I do stupid things like 7:30 on a Friday night when I should be having a glass of wine and watching the footy, I'm listening to European webinars where there's a Portuguese guy, the Portuguese running the EU now, and there's a guy who's a Frenchman who worked on the Paris Accord, and there's a couple of Scandies, and three people from China, and a guy from Poland, and they're saying, and the guy from Poland saying, we've got a coal-based economy, like Victoria, we've got to change, it's going to be really hard for us, but we understand the 2050 net zero target, you've got to help us get our economy up to where yours is already. Right,
yeah.
And they're saying, and you people in China, you got to help us too.
Yeah.
Now we don't have that conversation in Australia. They're going to get there. So, we got the situation where cotton farmers, for example, one of our great markets for Australian cotton is the EU. Last week we had the British Farmers Union saying, no, Mr. Dan Tia, you're not bringing your meat here because our beef growers and lamb growers in Europe, in the UK in particular, we now have to set, we're jumping pretty high hurdles in terms of how we're producing our beef and lamb. Mm. Why would we let you sell your stuff here that where your farmers haven't had to do that? No, that's now in our trade negotiations and we're not budging, right? The Germans are not going to let us bring our agricultural produce or anything else we export from this country into the EU with what they are calling now a carbon border adjustment mechanism. They're going to put a carbon price on our stuff as it goes across the border. Mm. So where's our trade minister? Where's our environment minister? Where's our prime minister explaining to Australian exporters, hey, or say, hey, look, we're just changing legislation because you guys, we want you to be competitive. We need exports. We've got to have money coming back into the country. We're going to assist you, but we're going to have to meet their targets. So we're raising our targets above them to make your job easy.
Yeah.
And why wouldn't we do that, given we've got every opportunity? I mean, just to put this in perspective, in about 2007, a guy called Albert Goller, German, running Siemens, huge tech company, came into our office in our little environmental consultancy and said, and plonked seven volumes down in front of me of a thing called Picture the Future, one on water, one on electricity, one on transport, one on whatever. And he said, Rob, I need your help. At just our company, it's got every technology we need to make Australia 100% dependent on renewable energy. And we could generate enough energy to export to Southeast Asia. I've got $2.5 billion to spend and I can't get a politician to talk to me.
Crazy.
Right? So, you know, Ross Garnaut is now saying this in a book called Superpower. We could become... So what do we do with our bauxite? What do we do with our iron ore? We take bauxite to alumina, simple technology, the whole world's got it, there's not much money in it. You know, we've got the biggest trucks in the world for getting it out of the ground, but we don't do the alumina to aluminium, the high value add step. And then we don't have a high value aluminium extruding mill, which is even higher value. Same with iron ore. We've got great big trucks digging iron ore out of the ground. What do we do? Put it in ships and give it to somebody else to make the money out of, right? Yeah. We used to make steel at Port Kembla, which we sold to Mercedes-Benz, and they used to put it in springs in their cars. We don't do that anymore. That's where the money is. We don't do that anymore. Yeah. But what Garnaut is saying is if we're smart, because we've got this wonderful opportunity with renewable energy, with wind and wave energy as well, but particularly with solar, I mean, big engineering companies call Australia the solar belt buckle of the world. He said, we could actually become the industrial powerhouse of the world, used to doing stuff with our iron ore and bauxite on renewable energy. So you go to market with zero carbon aluminium. Why wouldn't we be doing that? And that's where I get most frustrated is that this sort of lethargy, let's be polite and call it a lethargy, is just leaving Australia behind everybody else because this is what the rest of the world's trying to work out and we're just not in the game.
It's bloody frightening. Mm. When you consider all of the weather events that we expect with climate change...
Oh, we've already seen.
Yeah, we have. What concerns you the most? What are you most worried about?
Heat, yeah. And a lovely guy called Andy Pittman, who's an IPCC author from University of Sydney, and he received a nice little award from the Royal Society of Victoria last year, was it? Or the year before? Year before. We've forgotten about 2020. I mean,
what's gone?
All of our recollection. Is that, no, it wasn't 2020, it was 2019, which is an interesting thing to think about. Did research when I was chair of Greening Australia. So this is, we're going back now to the early 2000s, and he'd done this work to say the western suburbs of Sydney, the way we're developing them for residential housing, houses close together, dark roofs, he would basically say with no green links, nothing to keep them cool. He said these are going to become the energy ghettos of the next decade or so because the people are not going to be able to afford the energy to heat and cool these buildings.
Right.
So, you know, we are completely unprepared. What are we going to do when we're going to get a 50-degree day?
Yeah.
Right? Now, human beings can't live in that, right? Yeah. We've had 48s, you know, Black Saturday and days like that. And that's, you can't do that. Your pear trees, I'm looking out in the back here, they'll die. They can't, this stomata can't close tight enough to retain moisture and they'll just die.
Yeah.
50 degrees is even worse. So what are we going to do if, for example, and you can build these scenarios anywhere you like, we get a train crash at Euroa, right? And you can't drive on the Hume because the tarmac's melted.
Yeah.
Or you can't land an aeroplane, right? So we have no resilience. You know, they call it adaptation to climate change, but we've actually got no resilience built into our cities anymore. And we know, for example, twice as many people died in the 2 weeks before Black Saturday from heat than died in the fire. Now, fortunately, Black Summer, we didn't see some people died, unfortunately, but those events. But also strong, we got a windy day today. I mean, wind is going to become more of an issue because the way we're changing the climate, we're pushing the high pressure system further south, so those strong winds are actually, we actually got a windier environment. So that coupled with sea level rise means we get more coastal erosion, things like that. There's all these complex issues. I mean, one of the things I say is, you know, these wicked problems are not simple like economics. They're really complex. Mm. They're really hard. So, you know, but we get hours and hours and hours and hours of dull, boring, pitiful, pathetic economics rammed down our throats by our media because a few of us bought some Telstra shares at some stage in our life. And we actually don't deal with these real issues.
Yeah.
And we must. And that's what we need to turn our attention to about how are we going to redesign our cities. I mean, for example, does everybody know that Cummins, what do Cummins do? Make diesel engines for trucks, right?
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Right? Huge company. And you've seen, you know, for big yellow things that move dirt around and stuff, they all got Cummins, or they're big trucks. Cummins Diesel is going to become a hydrogen company by 2026.
Yeah.
They've just bought a diesel, a hydrogen business in Canada.
Brilliant.
Cummins is out of diesel.
Yeah, there
right?
you go.
So what's Australia doing? Okay. Now, I know Linfox, for example, is buying Volvo electric trucks. The Chinese only make electric trucks, by the way. diesel. What would we buy? Make diesel trucks. Hydrogen's coming like a tidal wave. How that actually plays out in the transport sector remains to be seen. Alexander Subic, who's now the Pro Vice Chancellor of Research at RMIT, would say, I reckon it's going to be 80% hydrogen, 20% electric. But the International Energy Agency last week, on the day that Josh Frydenberg released his budget, said, no more coal power stations. No, we can't do that anymore, mate.
Yeah.
No more fossil fuel, not new facilities. Let the stuff that's in place run out. Get rid of it quicker than expected if you can, because we're not going to keep under plus 1.5 Paris target, and certainly probably not even plus 2. Yeah. So, and it also means we see the end of the internal combustion engine in a decade.
Yeah.
I mean, the electric vehicle industry will tell you, yeah, we're going to have a big flip by 2028. You know, Volkswagen, their entire fleet, I think, is already electric. Volvo's already electric or hybrid.
Yeah.
You know, Ferrari's making hybrid cars for streets.
Yeah.
What do people think is going to happen?
Well, will corporations, will industry, business pave the way and leave politicians behind?
Oh, absolutely. Already is.
Yeah.
We desperately need our level of leadership. I mean, you're right, it is coming. I mean, the tech companies are doing really well. I'm working for a company now that's about to import some really clever Italian technology here before Christmas that recycles solar panels and gets 99.9% of the materials back.
Yeah.
So we're actually going to get about, I think $22.50 in materials from every decommissioned solar panel, which is a good business.
Yeah, that's great business.
But, and Deakin University is taking the silicon and already trialling it and taking that to nanosilicon, which is some ridiculous, like $4,000 a kilo or something like that. It's four batteries, right? And you can reuse the glass and the plastic and all the stuff. So we've actually got to invest in this new smart stuff. So the tech industry is working that out. because, and we're doing some good things. I'm going to give a bit of a rap to the Victorian government. I mean, some of the things that Lily D'Ambrosio's department is doing in, you know, we've now got circular economy proposition. We've now got banning on e-waste to landfill, so you can't put solar panels in landfills.
That's great.
As the EU has had for some years now. But we're the only state that's doing that. You know, why can't, you know, we have this meeting of premiers. Why don't they all say, oh, that's a good idea, Lily, let's do that everywhere. What do you reckon?
Yeah.
And Susan Lee should say, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do that nationally. Because that's going to drive a whole new industry, a whole lot more jobs. We're going to protect our resources. And we won't be worried about where we're going to get our lithium from because we're going to move to sodium-ion batteries maybe. I don't know, but you're right. Yeah. The tech industry's really got it, but we do need our level of support through legislation from our governments. Some of them are doing some useful things, but not like the EU. And they are really firing. And Biden's now doing, he's got $2 trillion for their Green Deal, $2 trillion put aside for their Green Deal. He's going to have a bit of trouble pushing it through, but he's got both houses and he's going to do it. And guess what? China's got a net zero target by 2060 as well, which they'll beat because they beat all their emissions reduction targets.
Yeah.
Had a bit of a flip in the last few years that they have had an increase in a few things. But what do Australians think's happening? I mean, what am I saying? You know, we're really not paying attention. And I think led by particularly federal government, our culture is to do as little as possible, which is a shame.
It is. It's a crying shame.
And do you think, is that led by fear of not getting re-elected if you make a mistake?
Yeah, I think partly. I think there's big vested interests at play in Australia as well. But I think, you know, this business of, you know, not wanting to change, I think it's a risk for a lot of people because they've effectively got to bring along their entire electorate with them. Come with me, guys. This is a better way to go. We're going to change. They go, what do you want to do? No, I want to do this because this is important. Let's have a look at this. These are people doing this. We're going to trade with these people. And you've got to have that multiple conversations about where the world's going. Come on, we've all got to, come on, let's all do it together. But we've got this adversarial politics in this country which is just debilitating. I mean, there's a guy called Luca Belgiorno Nettis who runs Transurban, and he chucks a lot of millions of dollars, I believe, still into a thing called the New Democracy Foundation, which is based, I think, still in University of Sydney, where the secretariat is. And his proposition is adversarial politics is killing our country, right? Because we get into a political stoush on everything, everything, and you hear people bravely say, oh, it'd be good if this was, you know, bipartisan. And you go, well, yeah, good luck with your project. Yeah. But he says, so he's got former premiers from both sides, Liberal and Labor, they used to have about eight. So Nick Griner's a Liberal from New South. And they say, look, you've got a wicked problem here. Let us come in and resolve the problem and move on.
Yeah.
And leave the politics. It's a really quite a good model. Yeah. So we need to think about things like that. How do we resolve these issues so that, you know, and to find the win-win-win scenario so we can all go, yeah, okay, I know we used to say that, but let's just park that or you do it and let's just do it the right way.
Yeah.
We've actually got to get a whole lot better at that, and that's part of the business of adopting new ways to change and effective ways to change. But, have a look around the rest of the world. But work out where you're going to get your information on this from, and there's one set of newspapers and radio and television stations you shouldn't get it from.
Yeah. Hey, Rob, you have been super generous with your time, and quite frankly, I could sit here for the next 8 days with, you know, several bottles of red wine and talk to you about this, but unfortunately we're just about out of time. Two questions. First one is a mate of ours, a very good friend of ours, Todd Lane, g'day Toddy, is a meteorologist, and every time we see him, we ask him, what's the weather going to be, mate? And he always delves into his pocket, brings out his phone and just reads it off the app. I'm sure you get that question all of the time. What do you say?
Well, the first thing I say is, where's your $10? You want a, yeah. You want a private forecast? That's going to cost you.
Yeah.
Depends. If people are polite, I'm happy to have a conversation.
Yep.
If people are impolite, I do what my mother says. What did you say? and I'll pull them up. But she was a very interesting teacher, my mum, but revered by most of her students that still speak to me about her. it's better to engage people positively in a conversation. So what do you think the forecast is? And I say, 22. I said, no, that's just the estimated highest temperature. Mm. And they look at you quizzically. I mean, I'd used to do this with prep kids, right? Grade twos are terrific. And I remember sitting at in my son's classroom talking to his group, his teacher, would you come and talk about the weather, Rob? Okay. And it was at the end of the millennium drought. And it was raining. And these kids, I couldn't get their attention because they hadn't seen, these were like 6-year-olds, they had never seen rain.
Yeah.
They'd more or less never seen rain. So it was fascinating for them. So the question is, you're in the playground at lunchtime, 2 days. First day, the temperature is 10 degrees, but there's no wind and there's no clouds. Think about that day. How do you feel? Think about that. Mm. Now, the next day, the temperature in the playground is 15 degrees, but it's cloudy and there's a really strong northwesterly wind. Which day do you feel warmest on? They know.
Yeah.
It's the 10-degree day with the sunshine.
Yeah.
Right? So don't be misled by knowing the temperature. Read the forecast and understand what it means. And that's the I like that conversation. Mm. But the people at the footy say, hey, g'day, Rob, what's the weather?
And will the Dees ever win a premiership?
Well, maybe. Maybe.
Maybe this year. But what is your take on that one? Can you win the
I think they were a bit off in the last game that they lost to Adelaide, but Adelaide played really well. I'm just looking, you know. I was 12 when I watched them win a grand final on more or less the last kick of the day in 1964. And some of the players from those days are just a couple of years older than me, and I know a few of them personally. I'm now working with a former Melbourne Football Club Brownlow medalist, Brian Wilson.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he's lost his Brownlow. He won it in 1982. Can't find it.
Can't find it.
Okay. But it's very dear to my heart, and my dear departed mum would be delighted to know they're going so well.
Yeah. There's a lot of people that would like to see the Dees win one, and for
I think it's our turn.
It has to be. Well, you know,
the Saints might argue.
The Saints might argue, but they've won one in the interim. Yeah,
they have. People don't see you on TV every day, or hear you on the radio every day now, and I reckon people will be wondering, you know, what's Rob do these days? Having had a chat to you and looking at what you do, you are probably busier now than, well, it appears outside of looking in than you've ever been. You're the exec director of your business, Rethink Sustainability, director at Attentis, and you're the newly elected president of the Royal Society of Victoria. When you think about what's next for you and what's next on your to-do list, what is what's next?
I want some of those businesses to flourish. I mean, they're all doing really good things and they're all kind of interconnected in a way. They're all good new technologies. They've all got a role to play. The Attentis Environmental Sensing Network technology would be really valuable. This is like fine-grained data, right. Weather, air quality, plus looking out and thermal imagery for bushfire detection and things like that. It's really classy technology that Cameron McKenna's devised. A couple of companies built smart water tanks, which have got their place. New one that's a fence, which is really nice. Yeah, you can trade water with your neighbour, and your neighbourhood can trade water with a water company. I've got a meeting with that coming up this afternoon. And Brian Wilson's company, Solar Recovery Corporation, recycling solar panels. They're all going to come along. Mm. Things are going to change. They're going to find their place. So I'm really comfortable with all that. And I do a lot of work sort of supporting other businesses as well. So, I mean, if I can introduce a good technology to another company, or you should be looking at this, I like to do that because we've got to bring on those things. We can't continue to live in fossil fuel world. We've actually got to think about some smart stuff. The Royal Society, I've been a member since 1978, just after I graduated. I haven't done much, but for a couple of reasons. I've got more involved and I found myself on the council. Okay, do I really want to do this? I've done a lot of work for non-profits over the years. Okay, then I'm, so now I'm president. So it's been around since 1854.
Yeah, what does the Royal Society of Victoria do?
It's about the promotion and advancement of science.
Right.
So I want to sort of shorten that. We've got to get our brand, whatever. So it's about giving science a voice or something like that. So this comes back to, science-based decision-making and its value. So, you know, we sent Burke and Wills on their ways, not our crowning achievement. But the Royal Society, 10 years before the exhibition building, for example, designed Melbourne's sewer system, designed our railway system, because the tech heads were all hanging around there. Mm. And we had business supporting science. And I want to build that relationship again, because we need to do that. We need to laud our scientists, because they've got... So I met the governor, right? She's a patron of the Royal Society of Victoria. And she said, look, I want to get more involved. I've come from a humanitarian background. I've just worked out that everything around me is science-based. You know, the tables, the chairs, my phone, everything comes from science. And we have to support that and build that, because that's our capability. That's where the value is.
Yeah.
So I want the Royal Society now to become a sort of a fulcrum or a voice for science and tech private world, and for the science and tech in universities. How do we make Melbourne, through the Royal Society of Victoria, how do we have a strong voice for science and science-based decision-making? That's probably my task in the next couple of years, apart from the business
stuff. Well, and I'm absolutely sure you'll make that happen, given your track record. From my perspective, you've sat in my living room for 30-odd years. In a box, and it's been an absolute pleasure, and it's been fascinating to actually have you physically in the house having a chat with us. So thank you so much, and thanks so much for your time, Rob. It's been amazing.
It's been a pleasure. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Cheers.
Thanks, Rob. That was Rob Gell, episode 45. Blake, what did you reckon?
I loved it. I really enjoyed listening to Rob's story. And, you see someone on the TV night after night after night, and you've just got no comprehension of, you know, who they are and what makes them up. He was just what a great man, what a great human. And all of the work that he's doing to make a difference is just fantastic. And I really can't wait to see what he does with the Royal Society of Victoria, that, you know, all of our big decisions moving forward need to be science and data backed, and that's what he's going to turn. You know, he's really going to put the Royal Society of Victoria on the map around the difference that they can make.
Yeah, I just loved his persona, and our first interaction with Rob was via email. Thank you, Marcos Codinho, for the introduction. And Rob's response to my initial email was, "Don't reach out. I'm likely not to respond." Air quotes, going forward, just call.
Yeah.
And just from there, I thought, I love this guy.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you the other thing that I loved about him was his hair. I want his hair, like just that.
You just want any hair, though.
That's true. That's like that beautiful, white, curly hair. Would you call it white?
I'm not sure. I think it's very distinguished. That's what I was going to say. He's very distinguished.
He is very distinguished. Very distinguished. I'd love to sit around a dinner table with, you know, four or five bottles of red wine with Rob. I reckon he's just got some great stories to tell.
Yeah, that's what sums him up. He is a fantastic storyteller. It's no wonder that he had so much success in TV and communicating. And you sort of look at it now and you go, four-day forecast, of course.
Yeah.
Of course that, you know, but you don't realise that someone had to come up with that as a concept, and it wasn't computer-generated. It was, you know, the old overlay slides and things like that to build a picture, to build a story, so that the average punter out there who actually relied on the weather, could be, you know, need to work outside or something the next day, they could actually visualize it. And, you know, he described it as a river of atmosphere above your head, and you sort of go, oh, okay, I understand now why tomorrow may be good or bad or whatever. River of atmosphere.
Yeah,
that's the t-shirt in that.
That is a t-shirt, you're right. We've had a bit of a theme of people that have been focused on the environment and sustainability throughout the Doolanders. And if you enjoyed that chat with Rob, who else could people go into the back catalogue and have a listen to?
Check out episode 12, Tim Washington, who started an electric vehicle charging infrastructure company called Jet Charge. That's episode 12. There's, of course, episode 23, Rachel Lowry, who's a chief conservation officer of the WWF, There's Leslie Hughes, who is just the pioneer of climate change, sustainability, renewable. And Rob Spurr, episode 27, who set up wind farms all over the globe and also set up AFL leagues in Asia and South America. There's Denny Walsh, who's a wind engineer and also a festival director. He's quite an entertaining listen. And then, of course, episode 41, David Ritter, the CEO of Greenpeace.
So there's lots of people that you can go and listen to. We'd suggest go and do that.
Yeah, we really hope you enjoy episode 45 of The Do Landers with Rob Gell. Catch you next time.
Boom.